And welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks again for joining us through WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and streaming live online all over the place through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. Investing in the stock market seems like a game for the rich, or at least people with enough disposable income to keep a minimum balance in an account with an investment company. It takes money to make money, goes the old adage, and the one percenters among us have been reaping the benefits of a healthy stock market, even as the Main Street economy still stumbles along. But some new companies are trying to make it easier for young customers and customers of average or modest means generally to get personal advice about appropriate investments at a reasonable price. Now, here are some companies that you might not have heard of yet. Market Riders, Wealth Front, Wise Banyan, Sig Fig, Folio Investing. All offer help picking investments, and none of them require a minimum balance. And there are many other companies out there like that. Our guest this hour is Ron Lieber. He's the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. And he recently wrote a column that caught our eye. Actually, it was a couple months ago, but we hung on to it because we wanted to get Ron on the show. With the headline, Financial Advice for People Who Aren't Rich. In that column, he writes about this slew of startups and what they offer. He also explains their pricing and services. So we thought this would be very helpful to get Ron on the show today. Beyond his column, Ron Lieber has authored or co-authored books related to finance since 2008 for the New York Times. He's written about everything from planning for retirement to smart ways to invest as a teenager with money from your summer job. So we're glad to get him on the show today. And by the way, before he went to work at the New York Times, Ron Lieber helped develop the personal finance website, FiLife. He also wrote for the Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, and Fortune. And we're lucky, it's our good fortune to have him on the show today. Ron Lieber, thanks for joining us on the Midday Show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad we were finally able to do it.
Yeah. You know, I've been doing a lot of back reading of your columns in preparation for the show today. Because I'd catch your byline from time to time in the Times and read your column. But then I just want to say, you write some great stuff. And there's a rich supply of good information in all of your pieces going back for a long time now with the New York Times, pardon me. And and I just want to recommend to our listeners, if they get a chance, to look up Ron Lieber, L-I-E-B-E-R, the Your Money column, if you haven't discovered it already. Check them out. A lot of interesting stuff. So we can spend part of this hour talking about investing for young people. But what caught our eye was financial advice for people who aren't rich in these startups, Ron. Can you tell us about them? What exactly is going on here that makes these companies tick, that makes them believe that they can make money off of folks who are, you know, wouldn't ordinarily be thought of as big-time investors?
Well, let's start with the problem that they're trying to solve. Okay. The problem that we have in America is that all of us, all of the sudden, although it's happened over, you know, a decade or two, are fully responsible, for the most part, for our own investments and our own retirement and all of the withdrawals that will come out of our retirement accounts. There are still some lucky people out there who earn pensions because they're government workers or they work for, you know, the few large companies left that have pensions. But a growing number of us really are responsible for putting all of the money away ourselves, picking the investments, managing them over time, figuring out if we've got enough, and then figuring out how to take the money out when and if we're able to retire. And that's all well and good for a small number of people who really know how to do this or who care to learn and want to manage it. But for many others, they want some help. And the problem with the financial help industry as it's existed for some time now is that it's set up mostly to serve the needs of wealthy people. If you want to work with a financial advisor who is going to act in your best interest and who is going to pick the very best investments for you and not necessarily the ones that allow him or her to, you know, earn the most commissions or the most money, it's very difficult to find somebody who you can work with, who's willing to take you on if you don't have a whole big pile of money. And so there's this vast hole for not just the working class and the middle class, but really a lot of the upper middle class too, that these companies are trying to fill. They're trying to help people with their investments and in some cases other parts of their financial lives, even if they don't have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank or in retirement savings.
So they're filling a niche. They recognize and are filling a niche, helping people sort through what's a very complicated thing and time consuming for the investment counselor. So I mean that is part of the reason why you write a large number of advisors won't get out of bed for less than $5,000 or $10,000 annually, drawn from a $500,000 or $1 million portfolio. These are pretty complex matters for people, and it's hard to sort out. Everybody's different, too.
It's true. The challenge for the people who provide this advice is that, they can make money through commissions on investments, but that means they may be tempted to put you in the investments that earn the most commissions for them, as opposed to
right.
the investments that are the lowest fees and are going to perform the best for you over time. And the best investments for most people over time happen to be index funds. Index funds don't pay commissions. So it's you're not going to find a stockbroker who's going to put you in index funds. Same thing's true with insurance. You know, everybody needs it. Some people need more than most. But the way that most people make money by selling insurance is, again, through commission. That's how insurance brokers work. And so, again, there's some question as to whether the person who is across the table from you is acting in your best interest. Now, there's a whole world of financial planners out there who work on what's called a fee-only basis. That means the only money they earn is the money that you pay them for their service and for their time. So they don't earn any commissions at all. So they're acting in your best interest. But most of those folks haven't found a way to profitably serve customers for less than, $5,000 or $10,000 a year. So what they'll want to take, 1% of your assets each year. So if you've got $500,000 in the bank, and who does, right? If you've got $500,000 in the bank, they'll take $5,000 a year, and they'll spend a whole bunch of time holding your hand and helping you with your stuff. And it does take time. Everybody is different, as you said. So the financial services industry has struggled to find a way to do absolutely right by people who don't have quite as much money without having to charge them, crazy commissions on products that probably are not in their best interest. And so that's where a lot of these companies are coming from.
Inexpensive advice, meaning no commissions, advice on index fund investments. And would you mind, just for those listeners for whom that phrase means nothing, index fund investments, what does Ron Lieber mean by that?
Sure. So there's a bunch of different ways to invest in the stock market. And we'll just talk about stocks now, not bonds or real estate or other ways to make investments. You can buy an individual stock. You could buy a share of Apple, or you could buy shares of McDonald's, or you can buy what's known as a mutual fund, which is a big collection of stocks. That allows you to get more diversification, so you're not taking quite as much risk. Mutual funds can work two different ways. There are managers of mutual funds who pick a whole bunch of different stocks in the hope that they have the magic touch and they can find the stocks that are going to do better than all the other stocks. And then there are mutual fund managers who say, you know what? I don't have the magic touch. Nobody has the magic touch. It's impossible to predict the market. And I'm just going to own every single stock in a sector. So I'm going to own all United States stocks, or I'm going to own all of the big United States stocks, or all of the small United States stocks. And that way, I know that the people who invest in my fund will get whatever the market returns. And studies have shown again and again over time is if you buy those index mutual funds and you hold them over time, you're going to do better than the vast, vast majority of these other actively managed mutual funds where the managers are running around trying to, beat the market and find the single best stocks on earth.
Okay, Ron, thank you very much for that. I mentioned these companies in the beginning, Folio Investing, here's another one, Future Advisor. I'm pulling this right off the chart that appeared with your column in April in the personal business section of the Times, Sig Fig. They require no minimum balance. So how do you get started with a company like this? Is it all online? Is it do you actually meet face-to-face with somebody?
In most instances, you do not meet face-to-face. There are a couple of these startups, LearnVest is one of them, where you can speak with a live person. That happens on the phone or via Skype, not in person. But you can get a human advisor who will help you with your finances generally. But as a general rule, there are kind of algorithms behind the scenes that are sort of building the portfolios for you. But there's basically two different ways this can work. You can go to one of these sites and you can say, okay, here's the money I have. Here's what I think it's for. Here's how much risk I'm willing to take on. And they often run you through a quiz. And then they suggest a portfolio for you that might be, 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. And those stocks might be divided up into index funds in the United States and in other parts of the world. And that way you get some diversification. And then, you push a button, it just buys that whole portfolio for you. So that's one way it can work. Another way it can work is that you go to these sites and you pay them for advice, based on your own circumstances. And then they email you a portfolio that they think that you should own. And then you go to a standard online broker like Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard, and you just buy all the stuff yourself. So the disadvantage of that second way of doing things is that you actually have to go and do it first and foremost. And then you have to resist the temptation to sell everything when the markets go bonkers or to, try and, still take a flyer on the side with Apple stock or whatever else catches your fancy. So, much depends on how hands-off you want to be or whether you want a site to do it all for you.
Right. Well, Ron, wouldn't a lot of people who are listening who are, say, have a 401k be familiar with this kind of service now online? You don't actually meet anybody, or you've got an index fund for most of your 401k, or maybe part of it is in stock, but for the most part, it's all being operated for you online.
Well, there's a couple ways to break down that question, right?
Managed for you, I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So in a standard 401k plan, somebody is making some choices about which investments you have to choose from, mm-hmm. right? You get a menu of 5 or 10 or 15 or maybe more in some cases, mutual funds. And then you have to pick from among those. And, you dump your 5 or 10% or 15% of your salary each paycheck, into those funds. And you're making the choice. So in some sense, you're selecting from a limited menu, but you have to pick from among that menu and decide what percentage of your money goes into each of those investments. Now, many 401ks offer something called a target date fund. And what that allows you to do is just pick one mutual fund, and that mutual fund might have a date on it that's associated with when you think you might want to retire. So let's say that's 2045. And you could just throw all of your money into the 2045 fund, and that fund itself is broken down among stocks and bonds and in the U.S. and in emerging markets. And so it gives you all the diversity you need in just one fund. So that's one relatively simple way of doing it if you happen to have access to a 401k or a 403b, which not everybody does. And then there's a third way this can work, where there are some providers of 401k plans who actually will, for an additional fee, manage your 401k money for you and pick the funds from the menu so you don't have to do it and make all of the adjustments that need to be made, and you pay some money for that privilege. So it can work in a handful of different ways.
I found your story, Financial Advice for People Who Aren't Rich, your column, very interesting, but I wondered the reaction to it when you lay it out like this, because this is a pretty good survey of these companies that offer help picking in rebalancing index and exchange traded funds or similar investments. And there's a, the list that was published in the Times, I think is about 11 on there. Did people say, well, this is more confusing for me now. I don't know what to do because I think I'm happy with the way things are managed now. I have a modest portfolio. This complicates things. How do you decide which one is best?
There's no easy answer to that question, and I wasn't trying to say that one or the other was better.
You weren't.
Because different people have different needs, right? Some people want sites that will do it all for them. Some people want sites that will give them some ideas and allow them to execute on those ideas. Some people want access to a human being. Vanguard, which is one of the giant mutual fund companies and 401k companies, they now have a service that more or less competes with some of these other ones. It's a little more expensive, but you get access to a real human being who can help you not just with your investments, but with everything else too. So different people have different tastes and different needs. What I was trying to do with the chart of that length was to say a couple of things. First of all, we seem to have turned a corner here in the ability for people of relatively modest means to get decent financial advice, and also sort of make a statement that we're going to limit this list here to organizations that are only putting people in index funds because we think that is what's best, for the vast majority of people.
Right.
And so, the list could have been longer or shorter depending on, kind of how I set the parameters, but those were the ones that I chose to set.
And very helpful. You list costs, the minimum balance required, and then sort of a description of what the company does and comments there. It's posted online at the Dan Rodrick's Facebook page. You're listening to Midday with Dan Rodrick's. Our guest, Ron Lieber, is the Your Money columnist of the New York Times. We can talk about these startups and investing, or you, if you have a question about anything related to personal finance, feel free to give us a call this hour of Midday. Our local phone number is 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. Or send in a question by email to midday@wypr.org. Especially interested in people who are new to the field of investing, have some money to invest or a small amount of money to invest. Please give us a ring in this hour of the show. Also, teenagers, young adults, getting into Roth IRAs as early in life as possible. More with Ron Lieber when we get back. And welcome back to Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number for questions for Ron Lieber, the Your Money columnist for the New York Times, who's joining us this hour on WYPR. And Ron, I'm going back to another piece that you had in June where you quote the CEO of Wealthfront, one of the companies mentioned in your piece about financial advice for people who aren't rich, Adam Nash. And I found this amusing that he says, if you read a book about investing and get excited, it's a bad indicator. Good investing is exceptionally boring, Mr. Nash says. This was a piece called Six New Ways to Measure Your Financial Goals. And these are like six points away of diagnosing how good an investor you will be. And I was especially amused by that because, people pick up a book on a flight somewhere. They read an article about investing, and then they get really excited about this idea of playing the stock market. Mr. Nash seems to think that you're probably not a good investor if you get too excited.
Indeed. I was just bouncing email back and forth with my editor before I came on, and I sent her a link to a financial planner's site. His name's Alan Roth. He works out of Colorado, and his URL is daretobedull.com.
I like it.
And you hit on an important point there, right? Index funds, which we were talking about before the break, which are these mutual funds that allow you to buy the entire market instead of trying to figure out which stocks in the market are going to outperform. Mm-hmm. Index funds are kind of boring, right?
Yeah.
You put your money in these things, and what do you have to brag about it at a cocktail party? It's not like the index fund is going to go up fivefold in the next 6 months the way that one or two stocks might or might not.
Let me tell you about my Vanguard. How exciting!
Right.
How exciting is that going to be? Right, I know what you mean.
Yeah, exactly. Americans are gamblers, right? There's a reason why Las Vegas exists. There's a reason why people go to the track. It's entertaining. People enjoy it, and I don't have any problem with that. But as the stakes get higher in your financial life, I question whether it makes sense to, you know, gamble with some or all of your retirement money in the same way that you gamble at the craps table, or that you, you know, gamble when you go and you bet on the Preakness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the point here is that it's perfectly fine if, you know, for entertainment value, if you have money that you can afford to lose, you know, that you take a flyer on some or another stock, you know, there's no problem with that. But I just think that it's a mistake for, you know, most people to attempt to, you know, outperform, you know, the index funds with most of their retirement money. It's just too much too much of a risk at stake.
Let's just take a moment and talk about savings then. Is it a mistake just to save money, to put it away in a savings account, when you could, as your article demonstrates, as the existence of these companies demonstrates, you could be doing more with it?
Well, it depends on how much you save. And it depends on the prevailing interest rates in savings accounts. I mean, right now, savings accounts are earning basically nothing.
Right.
There have been times in the past, and there will be times in the future, when savings accounts earn 3, 4, 5, 7, 8%. But the thing that you have to think about is, okay, well, you know, if we assume that inflation is going to keep going up at, you know, 3% a year. How is my savings going to keep up with inflation? And am I going to have enough money once I do save to meet whatever my goals are? And the problem with saving enough for retirement is that, you know, unless you can save 30, 40, 50% of your paycheck each year, you need to have that money grow faster at a higher rate than it will if you put it in a savings account. And so people need to take a little bit more risk by investing in stocks and bonds so that they could actually enjoy some of their money in the moment and not have to put aside, you know, 30% instead of, you know, maybe 10 or 15%.
410-662-8780 is our phone number for Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Ron Lieber, who writes the Your Money column in the New York Times. And lastly, before we go to the phone lines, I thought this piece you had just last week, August 1st, for teenagers, starting and saving in a Roth IRA. We think of a Roth IRA as something you do maybe after you get out of college and find a job somewhere. Roth IRA is very appealing. You say, why not start when you're a teenager?
Right. So I'm obsessed with the whole question of how parents can help their kids build good financial habits that are connected to the kinds of values that we want to, you know, imprint on their silly little heads, you know, for the 18 or so years that they may actually pay attention to us. I'm actually working on a book about it right now called The Opposite of Spoiled that's coming out in February. And so this was one of the things that came up along the way. I heard just some, you know, incredibly moving stories from people who are adults now, whose parents, you know, back when they were 14 or 15 or 16 and started to have a little earned income, helped them put the money away in some kind of long-term savings vehicle, usually an individual retirement account. And then the Roth came into existence, whenever it was, 10 or 15 years ago. And those folks are so grateful now because, you know, now that the money's had 10 or, you know, 20 or 25 years to grow, they see what an incredible gift it was for their parents to help them set this money aside early on. So it had a chance to grow and earned what's known as compound interest. So it kind of grows and feeds on itself over time. And that's made it easier for some of those people. I'm thinking in particular of a friend of mine who lost her home to a fire. And retirement savings was not possible for, you know, years after they lost their home because they were trying to rebuild their life. And she was so intensely grateful for her father, her late father, actually, who had helped her set up this retirement account because she didn't have to feel so badly then about not making the retirement savings. And that was an incredible gift to have provided, you know, not just the money, but also the ingraining the habits. And so I wanted to just do the math for folks so that they would understand that the difference between starting at 16 versus 22 or, you know, 18 versus 25 is a difference that can actually be worth hundreds, plural, hundreds of thousands of dollars in extra money later on, which could mean, you know, being able to retire a year or two earlier or not running out of money or being able to help grandchildren with their own college tuition.
If you take $5,000 in savings from a few summer jobs and put it in a Roth at age 19, it will grow to $52,006 by the time you're 67 if it grows at a 5% annual rate. And Congress doesn't change the Roth IRA laws. But anyway, wait until, by comparison, wait until 25 to start with that same $5,000, and the balance at age 67 is just $38,808. So roughly a difference there of, $14,000?
About $14,000. Yeah. And again, that's assuming you don't put any more money in at all. But once you start, you know, shoveling the maximum amount in each year, which is $5,500, you know, once you're working, or if a parent or a grandparent is able to help you through some, you know, matching contributions, you know, until you can make the full contribution yourself, then that's when the numbers start to get big. And, you know, 5% is a pretty conservative assumption. You know, if you go back over 20, 30 years and look at people who were invested in, you know, 70% stocks and 30% bonds, they actually did much better than 5% over time, but, you know, trying to be conservative.
Right. Ron Lieber with us from the New York Times. Ron, let's take some calls, some questions from our listeners here at WYPR, 410-662-8780. Corey in Baltimore, we welcome you to the show. Go right ahead with your question for Ron Lieber.
Hi, guys. So I think I'm in a situation that a lot of people my age are. I'm a young adult. I've been investing for about a year now, and my main quandary is, it's a couple different questions, I guess. I would like to start putting the maximum amount towards my Roth IRA. It's not, I don't get a contribution for a 401k from my company. But my question was kind of, what value should I place on paying off my student loans versus saving for a down payment for a house, also versus putting that money into my retirement account? What would Mr. Lieber think would be the best, I guess it's some sort of equation or a calculation that I could do to, sort through those.
Okay, Corey. Well, the part of that question, your debt, your student debt, is that's an obligation, right? You know what that is, right?
Yep. So I've been paying, but should I save money aside to pay off larger amounts, or should I continue just making the minimum amount while I save for down payment, or what would be the best option there, does he think?
I see what you mean. All right.
So this is a tricky question to answer because, you know, I would need to know at least 15 or 20 additional things about Corey to even begin to give him advice. But here are the factors in play, right? So he's already started savings. That's great. We know that he's not getting a matching contribution, you know, from an employer, which is too bad. We don't know how old he is. And this is something that matters with a Roth, because the beautiful thing about a Roth, again, as long as the rules don't change, is that that money grows over time. You pay no taxes on it. And then when it comes out, you don't pay any taxes on it then either. So the younger Corey is, the more that money has time to compound and grow and turn into a really big balance if he keeps contributing to it, that will then come out tax-free. And I think our taxes are probably going to be higher 30 or 40 or 50 years from now. They're certainly not going to be lower. And so, you know, that would suggest that Corey really ought to try to save more. But it's possible that his student loans are all private loans, not federal loans, and maybe his private loans are at, you know, 8, 9, or 10%. There's not a great chance that the Roth is going to grow at 8, 9, 10% annually. So if he's got really high student loan interest that he's paying, then he probably ought to be putting as much money as he can towards that high interest debt. And then he also mentioned the possibility of saving for a down payment.
For a house.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, much depends on his situation. You know, I don't know if there's a Mr. or Mrs. Corey involved in his life who may be you know, kind of weighing in on this. I don't know, you know, how good the rental housing stock is versus the, you know, owned housing stock. And, you know, sometimes that can make a difference. I mean, quality of life matters, right? And if the rentals are terrible and the stuff that you can own is much better, you do want to feel good about your life. That's worth something. And so maybe he would tilt more towards that if the rental wasn't making him happy. So these are all the questions that, you know, I would ask and we would need to talk about for, you know, 20 or 30 minutes to get a good beat on it. But these are certainly the questions he should be asking himself.
And I don't know if he's done this yet, met face-to-face with a financial advisor. I mean, what do you think about that? Some people charge by the hour, of course. Some want to take a small fee. There are different ways of doing this.
Sure.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that there are people who work by the hour. You can go to a site called the Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, Garrett Planning Network. And these folks are among the, you know, handful of I think there's hundreds of Garrett planners now all over the United States, but among the small handful, relatively, of people in the United States who will give you financial advice by the hour and will agree to act as what's known as a fiduciary, which means they act only in your best interest. And so they're not there to sell you insurance or, you know, lousy mutual funds that will have really high management fees and cost you money. You know, for someone like Corey to spend a couple hundred dollars on 2 hours of advice might well be worth it, because, you know, it can make a huge difference over what sounds like, you know, another 30 or 40 years of what he will have left to work.
Another call from Baltimore, and this is Harry. Harry, you're on Midday. Go right ahead with Ron Lieber here.
Hi. So I'm a 16-year-old guy, and if I have $500, what's the best way now that I could invest it?
Well, Ron, you want to take that? Because you just finished writing this piece about the Roth and teenagers.
Sure. If Harry's still on, can we find out what the money's for?
Yeah, Harry, go ahead. Can you answer a couple of questions from Ron?
Yeah, sure. Right. So this money was actually something that I got from my grandfather when he died. And I'm looking to see, my brother and I were looking to invest it possibly in stocks, but wanted your take on what might be the best way, either best way to put it in stocks or if that's not really the way to go.
Sure, but what do you want to do with the money someday? I mean, is it for college? Do you want to, you know, use it to buy an apartment one day? Is it for something else that you've got in mind?
So we were looking to we were really just looking to see what would be the best way to invest it to make it grow. Not super long term, within the next couple of years.
Okay, so maybe you want to spend whatever grows to in a couple of years?
Yeah.
So maybe for a car?
Yes, a car would be a perfect thing. A car,
right, there
before
you go.
Cars, something.
Am I helping you out here, Ron?
Like,
am I helping you out here? You get in a picture.
You are, but
Harry,
yeah,
Harry,
I mean,
and his brother. All right, go ahead.
Sure. So, you know, once again, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 other questions come to mind. You know, it sounds like if Harry's got this money to spare and his grandfather was nice enough to leave it to him, that he's not kind of living on the edge, right? He doesn't, you know, need to use it to contribute to, you know, his family's monthly budget. His parents don't sound like they've confiscated it or asked him to you know, contribute it towards college, or maybe he's decided that he's not going to go to college or he's going to go into the armed forces. And so I would be tempted to tell him to use this as a learning experience, right? If he's inclined to buy a stock, and I do not give stock tips ever. I don't do it in the newspaper. I won't do it here. I am certain that I do not have any special ability to predict what's going to happen with certain stocks or in certain parts of the market. I know for a fact that Harry doesn't either, no matter how smart he is. But there's no better time to learn that lesson than now. So, you know, if he's inclined to take a flyer on you know, his favorite restaurant chain or the company that makes the car that he wants to buy and that all of his friends want to buy, I say go to it. You know, watch that stock every day, learn about the company, figure out how the stock market works, learn a little bit more about, you know, competition in that industry. You know, let him watch this stuff and he'll see just how hard it is. You know, chances are the stuff that he buys, you know, the stock that he buys probably won't go to zero, so he won't lose anything unless he's, you know, investing in speculative stocks. I did a blog post for our parenting blog recently about all the kids Harry's age who are all of a sudden really keen on investing in marijuana stocks. I think some of those could go to zero. But again, this is the time to learn those lessons.
That's right.
Yeah, and he should go learn them.
Okay, thank you. Ron Lieber is our guest. We'll be for the remainder of the hour here on Midday. 410-662-8780. And for Harry and others, for teenagers, starting and saving in a Roth IRA, Ron Lieber's column from August 1st is posted on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, or just go to the New York Times. You can find it there. Short break. We'll be right back. Still ahead in Midday's second hour, Chinese Americans are among the nation's best educated and highest paid citizens. Does modern Chinese culture somehow confer on them a competitive advantage? What does it mean to be Chinese American in today's society? Eric Liu, a former speechwriter for President Clinton and a writer for The Atlantic and CNN, talks about the Chinese American dream when Midday continues after the news at 1. And this is the Midday Show with Dan Rodericks. Ron Lieber is with us. He writes the Your Money column in the New York Times. And Ron, well, we were speaking earlier about financial advice for people who aren't rich and the companies that have popped up and developed programs. I don't think we mentioned the fact that while their original idea was to go after younger investors, people over 50 have shown a lot of interest in this niche. And there's even one company, Betterment, that has a way of helping you figure out what's a safe amount of money to withdraw for your retirement each month. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's not surprising that people are asking for the help. I mean, this is hard math to do, right? You turn 60 or 65 or 70, you've got, you know, hopefully hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, sitting in an account after, you know, decades of saving. And you don't want to screw it up. You don't want to run out of money. You don't want to make the wrong assumption about how quickly the money that's there is going to continue growing when you hopefully live for another 20 or 30 years. And you don't want to grab too much of it at once. You don't want to do it in a way that will cause you to have to pay more taxes than you might otherwise. So, you know, it makes perfect sense that people would want some help getting money out in the same way that they often want help putting money in.
Let's take another call, another question for Ron Lieber. This is Alice in Baltimore. Alice, you're on Midday. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a young adult. I'm 21, and my boyfriend's 26, and we're both really considering investing some of our extra money instead of saving it. We're both sort of interested in that gambling aspect mentioned earlier. So, yeah, we keep track of some stuff on a phone app, and we're just wondering what sort of investment companies would take us seriously at our age, and would it be better for us to do that index mutual fund, or should we handpick some companies that we think would do well or that appeal to us?
So it sounds like the two of them, and I don't know whether they're planning on opening a joint account or two separate accounts, but it sounds like they already have some money put aside. And most of the kind of newer brokerage firms, where, you know, and by newer I mean not as old as Merrill Lynch or UBS or Morgan Stanley, but, you know, newer ones like Fidelity, like Charles Schwab, like Vanguard, like E-Trade, like TD Ameritrade, they will take in customers who only have $1,000. In some cases, just a couple hundred dollars, or maybe even nothing at all, as long as you agree to automatically transfer a certain amount of money each month. So they'll be able to find people who want to work with them. And if they're going to be doing it themselves and making their own trades, then any of those companies that I listed will do fine by them. So one way to think about this, if you really are tempted to kind of, you know, test your mettle in the markets and, you know, prove to yourself what most people who study this know to be true, which is that you're not going to outperform an index fund over time, is that you can take all of the money that you need, say, you know, the 10% that you want to put aside from your paycheck each month. And you can put that in a collection of index funds or in a target date mutual fund. So you know that that money is invested in the right way. And then you can take whatever's left over, whatever, you know, mad money you have that you can afford to lose. And you can pick a stock or two or five or six, and you can see how you do over time. Don't make the mistake, though, of thinking that, you know, because you outperformed the index funds over, you know, 6 months or 12 months even, that you're some kind of a genius. Again, you know, the science and the studies have proven again and again that stock picking is something that we should do only for entertainment, and it is only the lucky among us who really manage to do better than the market returns that the index funds deliver over really long periods of time.
Is a question that came in by email from Matan. I'm afraid that with index funds, money will go to unethical companies. Do green funds do well? Are these companies regulated the way traditional institutions are?
So that's a great question. Because index funds buy every company that exists in the market or in a particular space in the market, they're not making any sort of ethical decisions or putting any screens in on saying, I'm not going to have any tobacco companies or I'm not going to have any polluters in the index. There are a few mutual fund companies that provide socially conscious index funds. So you can Google that term and look them up. There's a company called Domini, I believe it is, D-O-M-I-N-I, that provides an index that mutual fund companies use to create a more sort of socially conscious index fund. And sometimes those funds will do a tiny bit better than the regular index, and sometimes they'll do a tiny bit worse. It sort of depends on how they're constructed. But for someone who's, you know, concerned with ethical investing, that's a good way to go and still get the benefits of indexing.
Hey, just to the point you were making earlier with our earlier caller just a moment ago about, you know, thinking that you can pick stocks better than the next guy. I go back to this piece you had in June, Ron, 6 new ways to measure your financial goals, actually your financial IQ, your financial acumen. But you say here IQ is a factor. Just because you can solve doctoral level math problems in the realm of data science does not mean you can also pick stocks that will outperform the rest of the market. But many programmers with high IQs try anyway. They do it so often that this fellow that you quote, Adam Nash, the CEO of Wealthfront, one of the companies we're talking about today, he's developed a presentation that he delivers in front of groups of people like this to try to talk them out of it. That gets us back to that thing about if you read a book about investing and get excited, it's not a good indicator.
Right. I mean, the worst offenders in that realm are physicians because they can literally put their hands on people and save their lives, diagnose life-threatening illnesses, and then fix them. So, you know, once you're a master or mistress of the universe in that way, you're tempted to think that the stock market is something that you can conquer easily. And, you know, many of these know-it-alls will, you know, pour a ton of money into pharmaceutical stocks in areas that they think that they know well. And that generally doesn't go so well. They tend to take, outsized risks, in particular the surgeons, and that concentration in and of itself, investing just in one area of the market, you know, puts you at a ton of risk. Mm-hmm. So it's great to have a high IQ, but that doesn't change the fact that the markets are unpredictable, that there's a ton of stocks out there, and no one has the ability to pick a group of stocks that will outperform the indexes over a long period of time. Or in the very least, there will always be people with luck, right? And there are certain mutual fund managers. I'm sure people who are listening are howling about Warren Buffett right now. It's true. Buffett has outperformed the indexes over time, and there are a handful of others who have done it over decades. So I shouldn't say that nobody can do it. But we don't have the ability today in 2014 to predict who will be able to do that over the next 40 years. Again, there'll probably be a handful of people who will, but how do we know who they are? And how do we know if the people or the companies that have managed it, the funds that have managed to do it in the past, will continue to do it in the future, particularly when Warren Buffett dies, right? You know, somebody else will take over that fund, and how do we know whether that person will have the same abilities? So it's just a very, very difficult thing to do. But that doesn't stop a lot of people from trying.
That's right.
In part because it's kind of fun.
Yep. Here's another question for Ron Lieber. Connor in Towson. Go right ahead, Connor.
Hi, yes. So I'm a 27-year-old male. I've had a 401k for a long time. I started when I was 19 because my employer had a match. I give 12% of that now. I also contribute a full amount to a Roth IRA, $5,500 every year. And I also have a discretionary investment portfolio as well. I'm just wondering what other things can I do that are going to help me? Because I'm really concerned that I'm not going to get Social Security by the time I retire.
How old did you say you are, Connor?
27.
27, okay.
So I obviously have 40 more years to go before I'll qualify for Social Security benefits. And I just want to make sure that I have enough saved, you know, for when I do retire that I can live comfortably and take care of my family.
Well, I mean, it sounds like this gentleman is doing almost everything right. We don't know that much about what he's invested in, but he certainly seems to be saving enough. So that's fantastic. And if he continues at that pace, he's going to do fine. What we don't know is what's going to happen to his employability, right? And so the question then becomes, if you feel like you're saving enough, what are you doing to invest in your human capital? And maybe that's additional training. Maybe it's a graduate degree. Maybe it's, investing in sort of spending more time at industry events or going to conferences that your employer doesn't pay for, doesn't want to send you to. It's investing in kind of making yourself smarter and continuously employable or finding your way to an industry where the amount of time that you will be able to work will be up to you and not up to some boss who pays you. So, that could be any number of industries, right? But it's, how am I going to kind of control my fate over a long period of time in an economic environment and perhaps, an industry or industries that are constantly changing? So that would be the next thing that I would challenge him to think about.
We're almost out of time. We have time, though, for one more question. George in Anne Arundel County, go right ahead. You're on with Ron Lieber.
Thank you. I'm wondering, since there's a lot of buzz the last few years about crowdfunding, and some of it's done for, I guess you'd say, social purposes, finding a good cause, but some of it's also just straight out business investments, and wonder if there are any particular sites or statistics that are better than others and indicate how risky this is. I assume it should be basically Las Vegas type money.
All right, George, thank you.
So there's a couple different ways to look at this. The way that most people encounter crowdfunding is through a site like Kickstarter. But a site like that, which does refer to itself as crowdfunding, that doesn't necessarily promise any return. I mean, you put $25 down on somebody's, film or somebody's attempt to create a CD or open a restaurant, and what you get back maybe is a T-shirt or a download or a couple of free drinks. This isn't the way to invest. So I think what he's probably referring to are sort of peer-to-peer lending sites. So basically what you do there is that, people who want to borrow money come to the site, and people who want to lend money come to the site and kind of deposit money in a pool. And sometimes they, pick individual people they want to lend money to, or sometimes they trust the site to do it for them. So a site like Lending Club is a peer-to-peer lending site that's probably worth looking at. Some people also invest in sites like SoFi, which help with peer-to-peer student loan offerings.
Ron Lieber, thank you for being with us today. And you've got a book coming out in February, The Opposite of Spoiled. We'll look forward to that and have you on the show again, I hope.
I hope to be here.
Yeah, Ron was great. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Ron Lieber, who writes the Your Money column in the New York Times. You can find a link to the stories we discussed today on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. We'll take a break now for lunch. That's the end of our first hour at midday. Another hour coming up. Lunch today provided by the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building in Harbor East. Thank you guys for lunch. A short break, the news, and then the second hour of our show.